From WBUR Boston, this is Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Each week, we bring you the best of Boston University from the worlds of scholarship, letters, politics, and the arts. Tonight, we present the second of three installments from the annual lecture series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture is titled The Rebbe of Ger, A Tragedy in Hasidism. Introducing Professor Wiesel is Boston University Board of Trustee member Elaine Kirschenbaum.
When Rabbi Pollack gave me the honor of introducing Professor Wiesel, Nobel Peace Laureate, recipient of the Presidential Medal of Freedom, erudite Boston University professor, influential scholar, magnificent writer, president of the Elie Wiesel Foundation for Humanity, leader among men and women, knighted teacher of morality, confidant of presidents and statesmen, an old-fashioned mensch. For weeks, I thought to myself, how can I do justice to introducing such an amazing young man? I also spent some time listening to the quite remarkable and scholarly introductions to these wonderful lectures over the last 30-some years, from the likes of Dr. John Silber and Rabbi Joseph Pollack and other special guests. And I realized I had yet another challenge ahead of me. Then I sat back and reflected on Elie's many books and memoirs, from Night to A Mad Desire to Dance. I thought of the many lectures I have listened to each fall at Boston University and the cherished visits I have had with Elie, especially our visit together last month. And it became very clear to me that there's a theme that stands out when I think of Elie Wiesel. Last month, when I visited with Elie, we shared some personal thoughts, and he said to me, one has no choice but to go forward when you face difficult times. But, he said, we cannot go forward if we are alone. Elie Wiesel has never left any of us in this room or across the globe alone. Alone to struggle through some of the darkest days in mankind, with the horrors of the Holocaust, to the struggles of the Cambodian refugees, the Kurds in Darfur, to the current struggles in Africa, the Middle East, and even the Western world. Elie, who as a young boy lost his mother, his father, his little sister, and faced enormous suffering during the Holocaust, still found the strength to write and speak about these horrors to the world in the hope that the world would never experience such atrocities again. Unfortunately, the deadly effects of hatred have not gone away. Elie Wiesel never rests on neutral. He's always there to speak out, fighting to make our world a better place, and always carrying the torch of hope. Last year, when Elie talked with us about Kristallnacht, he stated that when one people are threatened, all people are affected. When Elie joined President Obama at Buchenwald, he said, memory must bring people together rather than set them apart. And during the difficult discussion regarding building a mosque near the World Trade Center, Elie said, let's promote religious understanding together. Elie reinforces for me the essential value in Judaism about remembering the past and learning its lessons. He instills in all of us the danger of anyone remaining complacent when darkness strikes. Tonight's lecture, The Rebbe of Ger, A Tragedy in Hasidism, intrigued me from the moment I learned I'd be introducing Elie. Having little knowledge of the topic, I did what any Boston University student would do, and I sought advice from those wiser than me, like Rabbi Joe Pollack and Rabbi Yisrael Friedman, and I did some research about Rebbes and Ger. While I will leave the fascinating and tragic story of the Rebbe of Ger to Professor Wiesel, I'd like to share just a couple of thoughts. I learned that a Rebbe is a uniquely blessed individual whose charismatic presence and deep-touching spiritual soul affects their Hasidic community, even the general Jewish community, and other communities who don't even know him in such a powerful way that it seemed to me one cannot really completely explain this phenomena. Professor Wiesel, in an address in 1992 at a congressional dinner in D.C. on the occasion of the Lubavitch Rebbe's 90th birthday, said, the Rebbe manages to convince the rich to give, teachers to teach, and students to study. He manages to do things normal human beings wouldn't even dare of undertaking. I also learned that Gair, a modest town in Poland prior to the Holocaust, was probably the largest and most important Hasidic group in Poland. I understand they had a remarkably fiery passion and joy in their service to God despite adversities. While most perished during the Holocaust, today it is again vibrant, based in Jerusalem and B'nai Brak, named after their founder, Rabbi Yitzchak Meir Alter, the Rebbe of Gair. One can easily imagine how important such a Rebbe must have been then and is now. I end with two last thoughts. October 7th, the National ADL presented the prestigious Daniel Pearl Award to Spanish journalist Pilar Rahola. Mr. Rahola ended his poignant speech with even more poignant words from Elie Wiesel. I quote, "The opposite of love is not hate, it is indifference. The opposite of beauty is not ugliness, it is indifference. The opposite of faith is not heresy, it is indifference. And the opposite of life is not death, but indifference between life and death." We must all take Elie's message and live it. There's a Jewish tradition from the Talmud that there are 36 hidden righteous noblemen on the planet at any given time. Elie, I have no doubt, is one of those noblemen. Fighter for human rights and treasured friend, I present Elie Wiesel.
Elaine, thank you very much. One correction. The 36 men who are supposed to help the world maintain its own life and existence are hidden. They have to be hidden. The moment one is revealed, he's no longer one of them. So from now on, there are only 35. Dr. Silver, Provost Campbell, and my good friends. Those of you who have studied Hasidism here in this place for more than 3 decades know that it is supposed to bring joy, to dwell in melodies, and it is also supposed to glorify exaltation. It is therefore a question which I must address. Is it conceivable that inside the Hasidic movement there should be an extraordinary spiritual community that teaches us that from the very depth of great personal sadness a moving and powerful appeal is issued for continuous faith and renewed joy? No Rebbe suffered more in his life than Rabbi Yitzchak Meir Alter of Gair. And yet, how is it that his life story contains a warning not to give in to distress? His tales bring forth numerous questions. For instance, Hasidism is also based on fellowship and friendship. But can an excess of either or of love be counterproductive for the soul? Could too much affection become too dangerous for the mind? Or to quote a French poet, how far in this field as well as in others may one go too far? So the master who is our guest of honor tonight would probably answer in the affirmative. To him, both the mind and the soul are in constant need to be sharpened, challenged, and awakened. Belonging to the third generation of the Beshtian Hasidic movement, known throughout generations of students and teachers with his books on biblical and Talmudic commentaries, called the Chidushei Ha'arim. He is the founder of the School of Ger, which ranks today among, as you heard from Elaine, it ranks today among the most pedagogically flourishing and politically influential in Israel. And also, though to a lesser degree, even here in America. I admit I like him very much. Not like Vizhnitz, but Ger nevertheless appeals to me. But then I like them all, each and on every one, for his own way I like him, for his own qualities, style, and mystery. And though I remained an admirer of Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, as I was close to the late, great Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Lubavitch of blessed memory, and though I claim my allegiance to my Vizhnitz, that of my childhood, I continue to be attracted to the passion for learning and the fervor in worship one finds in Ger. I remember while still a bachelor, it is in the Gerer Shtibel, a kind of small oratory, a small room on the ground floor of the 101st or 2nd Street with my friend and ally, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. He would come on the Sabbath and holidays to attend the services in a nearby Gerer Shtibel. And there we too part in the yet inspiring way of addressing our prayers to the Lord. Often we would meet there friends who remembered pre-war Ger, the Blabele Tzivyak, the Yiddish chronicler Rabbi Yosef Friedenson of the Warsaw Ghetto, the Bavremele Zemba, all survived the Warsaw or Lodz ghettos, and some actually have returned from Treblinka. So, while listening to their stories, and listening to their prayers on the high holidays, crowning God as King of the universe, insisting on his divine justice and goodness, some of them, if not most of them, failed in a way to stand up, but nevertheless in their silence, they did reflect their own plight, that of the very first Rebbe, whose incomprehensible suffering on different levels, as we shall see later, preceded theirs and ours. A disciple and companion of great leaders, he too dominated the stage. Much is known about his public activities. From orally transmitted texts, chronicles, and letters, we get a lot of material. But who was he in his personal life? Did it have its own inaccessible secrets? What shielded him in moments of great grief? How did he reconcile intransigent scholarship and warm compassion, kindness, and rigor? How did he accomplish his own vision of Hasidism, and to whom did he transmit it? What was his concept of friendship, and how did he deal with its ruptures? If there is in every one of us an event, an episode, an encounter, a question, a story that defines us, what was his? We know that since his childhood, nothing discouraged him, no one frightened him. He always found the right answer, the right words to get out of any situation. Naturally, to get acquainted with him, one must look at his environment. To observe a character, one must locate him. And there we witness the first dispute dividing the young Hasidic movement. It opposed the school of Pshische to the house of Kozhenitz. Remember these two names, the two are pillars of the same edifice. In the beginning, since the revelation of Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov, or the Besht, in 1736, his movement, a kind of non-violent, really peaceful evolution in Jewish life, its progression was turned inward. His goal as well as his modus operandi were to attract a family here, an individual there, going from place to influence or enrich people, mainly poor and melancholy, with a story, a song, a smile, a blessing, even a handshake. There were no intrigues, no jealousies, no personal power-seeking ambitions among the disciples. In reality, serious and dangerous quarrels began only in 1772, when, following the passing of the Besht, the great Magid Rabbi Dov Ber of Meseritz took over the helm and imposed his socio-architectural vision on the growing movement. At that point, its adversaries, particularly in Lithuania, were the prestige of the Vilner Gaon, Gaon Rabbi Eliyahu of Vilna of blessed memory, was unequaled, emerged then there as their institutional opposition. Ideologically and practically, they waged an organized campaign denouncing the Hasidic behavior as heretical. Hasidim were accused of favoring prayer over study, of distorting old customs and rules. And these denunciations were meant to exclude them from the large community of Israel. In some cases, they turned to the police with weird political accusations. Some masters, such as Rabbi Schneur Zalman of Ladi, or Rabbi Israel of Rizhin, were actually sent to prison under false accusations. Still, these anti-Hasidic activities, though bitter and painful, never represented a serious threat to the Jewish people, for they came from the outside. Was it due to the astonishing success of which the Beshtian movement could be so richly proud? We know that the Besht himself has visited almost 300 cities and villages in his short life, although at that time all he had was a carriage and a horse and the driver Alexei. And how he did it, I don't know. Maybe nor did he. We are told that miracles occurred, that actually the coachman would turn his back to the horse, and the horse knew where to go. And that's how the Besht came to certain places. But one thing we do know, that everywhere Hasidism became a blooming movement. Its victories all over Central and Eastern Europe were numerous and glorious. Facing outside adversary was easy. Fighting inside opponents was not. Even the great historian who hated Hasidism, Gratz, even he admitted that without the Hasidic movement, who knows what would have happened to Eastern European Jewry. So we need also to remember that almost overnight, Hasidic schools and courts multiplied. It's simple. The Magid of Meseritz left many disciples who became masters, and each of them did the same. So their sons established their own little or not so little kingdoms in small cities and villages, resulting in unavoidable frictions and disputes, rarely between leaders, but often between their assistants and followers and advisors. Each and everyone saw in his master the only one worthy of wearing the Beshtian crown. In the annals of secular revolutions, resolutions, and events, such phenomena were frequent. Splits and counter-splits among the Jacobins in France, communists and Mensheviks in Russia, Trotskyites on the left, and the extreme left, everywhere else, these conflicts erupted. In general terms, We know that history is often shaped from the inside more than from the outside. And that happened also to Hasidism's so-called elite, which was concentrated first in Lublin and Pszczyce, and then in Pszczyce and Kozienice. Perhaps a recall of what Hasidism was then would be useful. It's always difficult to explain Hasidism to those who have not really lived it or even frequented it. I think years ago, when I began lecturing here on Hasidism, I had to tell the story of my good teacher, late teacher, the greatest that I had, at least in America, Rabbi Shaul Lieberman. One day he was rector of the Jewish Theological Seminary. And one day he invited his friend then, the great Gershom Scholem, the master of the study of Kabbalah. He is the one who actually established Kabbalah as an academic discipline. He invited him to lecture. Lieberman was a misnugget, was an adversary of the Hasidic movement. He comes from Lithuania, albeit Russia, Motole, the place Motole. And everywhere, of course, was very curious. So that many people came to the lecture, simply saying, how would these two men get along? And Lieberman had to introduce Scholem. And this is how he introduced him. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Scholem, Gershom Scholem, teaches Kabbalah at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. He teaches mysticism. What is mysticism? Nonsense. Of course, you can imagine the reaction in the hall. The elite was there. All the intellectual elite was really in that hall. Lieberman waited a second for the impact to disappear, and then he said, ladies and gentlemen, nonsense is nonsense, but the history of nonsense is scholarship. That is not true of Hasidism. It's not nonsense. It's a way of life. So actually, we know what the Besh wanted to do, really. The Besh wanted to say that God is everywhere. In pain, too? Yes, in pain, too. Especially in pain, perhaps. God is, and that means that he dwells in every human being. In the unlearned, too? Yes, in the unlearned, too. In the sinner, too. In the humble. In the humble most of all. He can be found. And he can be perceived by everyone. As he sits on his throne, said another of his friends and disciples, Rabbi Pinchas, God can be approached both through the tears of the penitent and the fervor of the worshipper. God is one. And that means he is the same to people who turn to him in different ways. And this offer of consolation was at the same time an appeal for unity, therefore, in the Hasidic movement. Within the Hasidic framework, Jews were told that they could fulfill themselves as Jews in more ways than one. The learned through their learning, the poor through their piety. God is not indifferent, and man is not his enemy. This was the substance of the Hasidic message. It was a message against despair, against resignation. It sensitized the individual Jew to his own problems and made him aware of his ability to solve them. It taught him that hope must be derived from his own history and joy from within his own condition. And then, therefore, we must know what happened later. And we are now at the beginning of the 19th century, right in the middle of the Napoleonic Wars, churning in blood and fury. Europe is turning itself upside down. Frontiers, thrones, loyalties, and systems change overnight. The earth trembles. Nations discover new passions, liberating but deadly. History moves and bursts into flames, and the blood flows. Priests change their styles, kings at their thrones. Patriotism, romanticism, nationalism, so many words newly come to life, powerful enough to drive man to breaking their visible and invisible chains. that was Hasidism too. It was a renewal. It was a new way to repeat ancient prayers and discover new roads leading one man to another, to his fellow human being. So, actually, after the passing of the Besht and his successor, the Maggid of Mezerich, it was only normal for Hasidism, as experienced in Lublin, where the so-called seer, the holy seer, reigned, and Kozhenitz in Przyszcze, to go through upheavals and crises of loyalty. Could one belong to more than one school? Probably not. To follow more than one path? Surely not. Is it then possible that the regular Hasid defined himself by his opposition to the one facing him, and that an adept of the fierce and irascible master of Kotsk opposed all of them? At that time, one could lose one's orientation following the split that plagued and perhaps on a certain level enriched the Besht's heritage. Ger was not part of them. Ger remained Ger. So what is the school of Ger? In the enchanted kingdom of Hasidism, especially in its developing phases, a master was distinguished by his miracles, another by his fervor, still another by his songs, still another by his silence, or by their methods to overcome melancholy. As for Rabbi Yitzchak Meir of Ger, of whom we speak tonight, he was known mainly for his passion for learning, to which he found his total fulfillment. Did it also help him in frequent moments of distress? Born in 1799, still a boy, he lost his father, Rabbi Schoel. He was a husband of Chaya Sorch, the Maggid of the preacher of the Kozhenitz, a servant or niece. Legend preceded his birth. While still in his mother's womb, the Maggid, the preacher, stood up when seeing the pregnant woman entering his study, saying, "I pay respect not only to you, but also to your son to be born. He already is a sacred scroll." Naturally, the Maggid took care of the little orphan and watched over his education. He must have been, and indeed was, a precious child. A fast learner, he surprised everyone with his quick answers to questions raised by illustrious adults. One day the Maggid turned to him and said, "I'll give you a golden coin if you tell me where God dwells," and answered the boy, "I will give you 5 if you tell me where he doesn't." Now you may remember that when we speak of other Hasidic masters, this had been attributed already to others as well. So what? Hasidic stories are beautiful, no matter who really they are. Later, much later, evoking his childhood, he would say that at the age of 8, he would be able to see and hear Prophet Samuel himself. Go and prove it. He was able, he said, even to see Prophet Elijah, in person. Yes, he said, he heard their voices. No wonder that the holy seer of Lublin commented on his soul as being of a high caliber. Quote, said the seer, "Yes, he is a man, a great man of a high caliber, but people will be made to suffer," he predicted. "People will make him suffer." In fact, he believed him to be a kind of reincarnation of the Messiah, son of Joseph, the first Messiah, the tragic of the two, who, according to ancient sources, will perish in an eschatological war. His reputation was so high that as an 8-year old, he received a strange proposal from a wealthy businessman. Reb Moshe Halfan came to see him and offered him to marry his daughter at 8. But he wished to meet first the young boy, known all over the region as the Polisher Ilui, or the Polish prodigy. And he submitted him to an examination, asking him a complex question drawn from the Tractate of Punishment. And the young 8-year-old student gave him an immediate answer that baffled him by its originality and depth. And the businessman right away realized that the boy's erudition surpassed his own. So on the spot, he made a decision and decided the student must become his son-in-law. It is said that the student actually consented, although he had already received a number of similar proposals from prestigious families. The reason, why did he accept? He was told that the girl in question was not really known for her looks. She was small, with a big nose, and well, let's be elegant and charitable and say no more. Anyway, the story was transmitted so as to illustrate the Rebbe's humane nature and compassion. He felt that if he rejected her, no one would ever want to marry her. How could he be responsible for her humiliation? And therefore, he decided to marry her. The wedding took place. How old was he? Surely after his bar mitzvah, a bit later. Hasidic sources are known for their imprecision. One text mentioned the figure 13, whereas others make him even younger. What we do know is that the Maggid of Kozhenitz himself officiated at his wedding, which must have been celebrated in customary Hasidic exuberance and enthusiasm. An immediate problem. The father-in-law, Reb Moshe Halfan, wanted the couple to live in Warsaw, stay with him, eat at his table, and go forward in life. But the Maggid, the master, preferred to have his famous Hasid and disciple with him in Kozhenitz. And the problem reached Lublin for a ruling. And the holy seer ruled in favor of the father-in-law. Rabbi Yitzchak Meir with his wife moved to the capital. To console the Maggid, he promised him frequent return visits. And then the Maggid, the master, passed away. His son, Reb Moshe, who succeeded him in the leadership position, treated the young scholar with special affection, admiration, and with great love. Was the young student still happy? The world outside was not a happy place. It wasn't happy because, we know, all kinds of things happened in Europe. And when people suffer, all people suffer. For the Hasidic movement, too, difficult and troubling times were on the horizon. So much so that three masters, died the same year, 1815. One was the seer of Lublin. The second was the Maggid of Kozhenitz. The third one was Rabbi Mendel of Rimanov. And they had taken part in a famous messianic conspiracy aimed at hastening redemption for our people and therefore for the whole world. And they would meet in secret with no one present, exploring together mystical means and methods how to put an end to exile and his woes. They surely knew that one doesn't enter that perilous domain with impunity, that Satan's word also counts in heaven. But they took up the challenge. And They died far from each other. Their followers must have been heartbroken. But as always in Hasidism, they learned how to overcome disappointment, misfortune, and sadness. But what about the Rebbe of Ger himself? He lost his master. Still adolescent, was he affected by all these dramatic events, or was he shielded by his young age? In Koznitz, he was admired for his exceptional erudition and eloquence. Many legends circulate around that part of his personality. Whenever there was a need for someone to go on a mission to defend Hasidism against accusations of Hasidic ignorance, he was chosen for the task. At a historical oratory dispute between old Pschische and young Lublin that was arranged at a rabbinic wedding in Ostila, he played an important part. He would refute any reproach and criticism with persuasive arguments. His learning helped him win many battles. It is said that he slept too little, 2 or 3 hours. Actually, he said that even 1 hour would be too much. His wife and friends invoked medical reasons, trying to persuade him to think of his health. And his answer to his wife was, "Why did your father make me marry you? Because for some reasons and in some circles, I was known as a prodigy." What is a prodigy? Someone who learns fast. Well, I sleep fast. Why has he left the Koznitz community where he was loved and appreciated? Perhaps because they loved him there too much, uncritically. He objected to honors and flattery. They would be a threat to one's idea of himself, he believed. "I," he once said, "need someone to tear my flesh, not someone to caress it." That may be the why he left the court of Koznitz and is warned for Pschische, where the great Rabbi Bunam, in the footsteps of Rabbi Yaakov Yitzchak, the Jew of Pschische, had established a new school where rigor and discipline were strict guidelines. He welcomed the new disciple with open tenderness, and yet the newcomer was still beardless. Again, the separation from Pschische and more dramatic elements and represented an important moment in his life. We must remember, after the passing of the master, the Magid Koznitz, Koznitz was no longer the same. His son, Rimoishe, did not have his father's stature. Known mainly for his piety and devotion, he wept all the time, but not enough for his learning. No wonder that the young student from Warsaw, who lived in meditation and study all the time, did not feel completely at home there. He felt better at Pschische. When he returned home from his visit, he found his first son dead. He connected the two events. So did the leader he had left behind. To his close followers, the new Rabbi of Koznitz remarked, "He, the Rabbi of Ger, the disciple of my father, now perturbed my Sabbath, and now his will be too." Since then, history repeated itself. Strangely, each visit to Pschische resulted in another death of one of his children. How many were there? Some say 11, others say 13, others even say 17. 17 visits. Both numbers all numbers figure in the Chronicles, and all brought 17 funerals. At one of them, the mourning father said, quote, "The day will come when we both, he, the Rebbe of Kozhenitz, and I will be in heaven together. And there and then I will sue him before this celestial tribunal." The Rebbe of Ger, a tragic figure? Yes. The most tragic, perhaps. Others were inflicted by melancholy, even depression. We discussed this theme years ago here. The greatest of the masters, even the best himself, the seer of Lublin, Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, all went through periods of depression. But surprising as it may sound, the first Rebbe of Ger, Rabbi Yitzchak Meir of Ger, who may have had better reasons that day, did not succumb to melancholy. Again, was he spared by his deep, incommensurable, and unfathomable love for learning that protects him? Can learning really protect a person of such tragedy? About him, we have learned many things after all, going through all of his books. Speaking of the martyrs of the faith, he once remarked, granted, a martyr of the faith who dies for his faith acquires in 1 hour his or her part in the world to come, but in one moment of vanity, of taking himself too seriously, everything is lost. He also said, before the ultimate redemption, the world will go through many trials, and all will aim at discovering the most inner point of the heart. He insisted on that faith a lot, the inner point of one's heart. He said there are many books on how to fight the evil spirit. The trouble is that the evil spirit also has written books on how to fight those who fight him. He loved to quote Rabbi Moshe Leib Sassover's aphorism, "The world is a dangerous place. It is like a sword's edge. There is an abyss on one side and an abyss on the other." He said, when Isaac was tied to the altar on Mount Moriah, all our souls were in his. He asked, why didn't God create the world earlier? And he answered, earlier than when? For God there is no before, no after. Why did God tell Abraham, the man of absolute faith, not to worry? Answers the Rebbe of Ger, because Abraham did worry. He worried that God might find another messenger worthier than he. He also loved Hebrew, the sacred tongue. He said, let the entire world speak Hebrew, and the Messiah will be here. Therefore, we have to wait so long. When Rabbi Bunam of Pshischa passed away, the circle of close disciples waited the traditional month of mourning before looking for a worthy successor. Two were considered worthy candidates, and both refused. One was the future Reb Mendel of Kotsk, who at that time lived in Tomashov, and the second was his friend, our guest tonight, the future Rabbi Yitzchak Meir of Ger. Both had been very close to the late master. In fact, the latter was at his best side during his last hours, listening to his last words. Rabbi Bunam asked him to burn all his writings to the last page, Nothing ought to be spared from the flames. Why? He gave no reason. And his disciple didn't ask for any explanation. He obeyed. Which reminds us of another great master, Rabbi Nachman of Bratslav, who had given similar instructions to his faithful follower, Rabbi Nosson, who also obeyed. As for the Rabbi of Ger, he himself burned some of his own written commentaries. Once at the request of his friend, Reb Mendel of Kotsk, and another time because we don't know why. In both cases, he threw his own writings into the fire while shedding bitter tears. Strange, this desire to erase all written traces. Was it to avoid false readings and interpretations, or to maintain the quality of the oral tradition that characterized early Hasidism, just as did early Talmudic lessons? The Besht himself hasn't left any of his teachings in written form. When someone showed him notes taken from his sessions, he said, "Nothing there is mine. It is the evil spirits." As I mentioned, both Reb Mendel and Reb Yitzchak Meir, true companions and devoted friends and allies, were subjected to pressures to accept the orphaned crown of leadership of the school of Pshischa, and both refused. Each pointed to the other, let him become the master's heir and successor. Finally, for the sake of Pshischa, it was left up to them to decide. And they met alone at a village named Samut. Isolated in an inn located deep in the woods, they talked and talked and talked. And what they said to one another, the arguments they used, the tone of their voices, no one knows to this day. But we do know that both emerged victorious. One returned to Tomaszów and Kotsk, and the other to Warsaw. Nevertheless, we also know that the future Rabbi of Ger saw in his friend the worthy successor to Rabbi Bunam, and he became his Hasid, his follower. Furthermore, he wanted everyone to follow his example. Whenever the Ger Rabbi met a young student thirsty for learning, he would admonish him, What are you doing here? You haven't been in Tomaszów yet. Go there and you will feel what our ancestors felt at Sinai. The wonderful and wonderfully disquieting Rabbi Mendel of Kotsk. We have evoked him here with fear and trembling years ago. Obsessed with truth alone, he sought its fiery power to extreme rigor and solitude. I revered this teacher, guide, and master, for whom life was meant a battlefield where one must walk, for whom life was meant to be a challenge, forever oscillating between the dizziness of the height and the fear of the abyss. Why did the Kotzke Rebbe avoid those who left the families behind and came to be with him? Oh, one day we shall return to him. But we are still in Ger, a small village, small city near Warsaw, which to Hasidic followers is even more famous and surely more meaningful than Warsaw itself. Rabbi Yitzchak Meir is still there in Warsaw for the moment, living with his father-in-law, who supported him and his family. His spouse, Feigele, worked in a textile store which her father had purchased for her. That was not infrequent in those times in the world of Jews and Eastern Europe. The wife worked as to allow her husband to explore and study the depth of religious wisdom. So for a while, she was the breadgiver of the family. Until the crisis erupted, some things changed. At one point in 1831, the new political situation, the Polish insurrection provoking Russian reprisals, affected Jews as well. In the battles, the textile store was demolished. The master's father-in-law, Reb Moshe Halfan, was forced to financially support the nationalist rebels. Their defeat resulted in his own downfall. Everything he had was lost. At one point, he was arrested. And since then, the Rebbe's family often suffered from hunger. Literally, from hunger. The great Talmudic scholar chose to go to work himself. He became the director of a factory that produced wool for prayer shawls. Naturally, the learned erudite scholar was a weak businessman. Total failure. He tried selling books. Same results. How about publishing books? He tried and failed. Speaking of his poverty, he once commented, "If I so wish, I could obtain from heaven to make money. All I had to do is to will it. But I prefer to submit to God's will than to ask Him to submit to my own." If economic troubles were insufficient, they were followed by more serious ones. Suspected of helping the insurgents, like his father-in-law, he, the Rebbe, was imprisoned by the Russian authorities. For how long? Again, we must admit our lack of precision. A day and a night longer? We don't know. What is certain is that he shared his prison cell with underworld criminals, and that his arrest provoked a wave of public protest all over, not only among Hasidim, but also among their antagonists, and even among Christians, so much so that the authorities had to offer him special apologies and asked him to stay put at home. Still no longer being safe and secure, he felt the need to change his address and name. From Rottenberg, he became Alter. That's why the name Alter remained part of the Gerer Rebbe's. At the same time, or soon afterwards, Warsaw lost his chief rabbi, Reb Shloime Zalman. The entire community was plunged into mourning. For 30 days, no public celebrations were allowed. No music was played at any gathering. Women would not wear jewelry in the street. So beloved were their spiritual leader. For his succession, the community's dignitaries and notables turned to Rabbi Yitzhak Meir, offering him a very high salary, and he said no. Other invitations came from prestigious communities, near and far. He still said no. In the meantime, his reputation grew wider and wider, reaching religious and social spheres beyond and outside the Hasidic world. When the school of Pshischer needed someone to delegate to other masters to explain to them the Hasidic message and way of life, it was to him they turned. When a delegation of Jewish leaders had to go to visit Sir Moses Montefiore, the famous philanthropist, to inform him of the plight of poor, impoverished Jewish families in Warsaw, he was part of it and its spokesman. And again, in general, what was his role outside the Hasidic world? We don't really know. Some sources maintain that his arrest was due to his activities against the forced anti-assimilationist policy of the government. Together with Rabbi Yitzchak of Vorki, the master who established the School of Silence, he fought against the laws prohibiting Jews from wearing their traditional garments and beards. In that fight, they also had to combat fellow Jews who preached total emancipation. Inside the Hasidic community itself, opinions varied. Facing the question whether pious Jews ought to violate the laws and risk prison or even death, some answered in the affirmative. Others, surprisingly including the Rebbe of Kotsk, declared that the choice of garments to be worn does not derive from biblical law and do not deserve to go to the limits of choosing death rather than transgression. After all, they said, didn't Uncle Esau wear Gentile clothes? And did Jacob, didn't he wear Gentile clothes when he appeared before his father, his blind father, Isaac? Eventually, the anti-Hasidic laws were defeated, and the Rebbe of Ger continued to live his life fully in his Hasidic universe, which suddenly underwent a convulsion, which on all levels, in every family and home, produced powerful shockwaves. And it came from Kotsk, where Rabbi Mendel began a process of personal withdrawal from his fervent, if not ecstatic, followers. He slowly but irrevocably made himself inaccessible, invisible, unreachable to them, locked in a secret quest which no one could explain in his small room. It is through a hole in the wall that he would observe students in prayer and discussions. And when he appeared, usually at night, they were seized with panic and ran away. Only two persons were allowed to see him: his servant Rabbi Hersch Tomashover and his friend Rabbi Yitzchok Meir. They did nothing to explain his retreat from everyone else. 20 years it lasted, until 1839. And there too, Rabbi of Kotsk, what a character. We have already studied his life and teachings. His dark fire continues to burn in my memory. His isolation aroused curiosity and anguish, and also resentment in his own circle. At the end, one of his favorite disciples, Reb Mordechai Yosef of Izhbitz, with a group of dissatisfied dissidents, left him and established their own little kingdom. They were a minority. Most disciples stayed where they were, and one of them explained his attitude. Quote, "The Talmud tells us of Rabban Gamliel's school that in the time of Hillel the Elder, only he whose inner life was reflected in his outside behavior was admitted inside, and for him the gates were open. Others were rejected," added the Hasid. "In Kotsk, what we do is simple. If the doors are locked, we break the glass and the lock, and we enter even through the window." In Kotsk itself, there was fear that the future Rabbi of Ger might join the dissidents. There were rumors to this effect, all unfounded. He remained faithful. He had a tremendous faith in friendship. And Rabbi Mendel thanked him for his loyalty, and he said, "You, Yitzchok Meir, you did not forget me, and I shall remember it until my last day." So may we imagine his friend happy? How could he be, when so many Jews in the region still in exile and during compression were waiting? And then also, how could a father who lost one child after another be happy? How could he be happy in 1839 when in Kotsk things worsened daily? Rabbi Mendel, his great and fearsome friend and teacher, was taken ill and refused to see doctors. The Rabbi of Ger was urged to intercede with him. He hurried there immediately, and the two friends spent hours together in isolation. And the illustrious, stubborn patient gave in. He took medications for a while, then he stopped. And the word spread that the end was nearing. Wishing to be there, disciples and followers converged on his home in Kotsk. They recited psalms, praying with their heart and soul for his days to be prolonged. And he heard them and commented, they would do better to spend their energy in study. Death did not frighten him. To his son-in-law, Rabbi Avrom of Sochachov, he whispered, "What is there to be afraid of? One leaves one room for another, a better one." And he added, "Study is what matters." He closed his eyes forever. Rabbi Yitzchok Meir was present at the funeral. He wept, saying, You don't even know what you just lost. Thus was officially born the school of Ger. It's not when the Pshischa Rebbe died. It's when the Kotzk Rebbe died. Was this school different from Kotzk? Very different in style. More bestian, accentuating collective fervor more than on solitary meditation. Here young students were not chased away. Too many arrived, so what? Never enough for those who loved learning in depth, a page, a problem in ancient Talmudic and their medieval commentaries. What was essential was the total connection with Torah, which means both practice and study. Hundreds, rumors spoke of thousands of followers hurried to spend Passover under his roof. And he would tell them, listen, I am not just a regular teacher for everyone. I don't need your money. Honors. I had enough honors in my life. I don't need more now. What I desire most is to have you penetrate by truth, by helping you come closer to our Father in heaven. And he who wants something else, his plate is not here. Eventually, he left Warsaw for the nearby Ger. His yeshiva, his school, attracted the best students, as well as their teachers, whose colleagues and friends he wanted to be. Among them were the greatest who embodied Hasidic thought, such as the Rabbi Chenoch of Alexander, Rabbi Akiva Eiger, Rabbi Azriel Charif, Rabbi Hesh Ashkenazi, Rabbi Shimon Sofer, and Rabbi Shol Salanter, the renowned, inspiring founder of the Musar movement, the movement of morality. What attracted so many people from so many spheres to him? He did not perform miracles. He was just a spiritual guide on whom they could lean in moments of distress or doubt. To them, his words had both strength and weight and occasional humor that resonated with joy in their hearts. One day he remarked, "It happens that you hear someone declaring that he is giving up on the world. But is the world really his for him to renounce it?" And also, one of the 10 curses that God sent upon Pharaoh's Egypt was darkness. The text says, man no longer saw his brother and not one moved from his place, commented the Rebbe of Ger. It means that he who does not see his brother will not move from his place in darkness. Incidentally, of course, the Rebbe of Kotzk had already interpreted this verse differently. It is not, said he, that people did not see one another because of the darkness. It was because they did not see one another that darkness existed. In other words, their own darkness was the curse in Egypt. Another day, Rabbi Yitzchak Meir recalled the sins of our ancestors that they committed while wandering in the desert. And he said, remember, it is with their sins that the Torah was made. And this, the Torah tells us that the voice of God was heard at Sinai. That means, according to the translation of Targum, that it continued to reverberate uninterruptedly, which means until today. For it is written, Hayom, today. Today you will hear my voice. And today means today, now. And also, in a Yom Kippur sermon, he quoted Hillel the Elder, who said, if I am not from myself, who will be? And if I do not what I must do, who will do it? And if not now, when? And the Rebbe went deeper into the questions. Well, when will this now be here? This now has never existed before and will never exist again. As the Book of Splendor, the Holy Zohar says, the garments of the morning are not the same as those of the evening. And again, he loved to speak of the inner point in all of us. It must remain stable and true. Let Satan move it an inch and everything is lost. In 1866, at the age of 67, he fell ill, physically probably mentally exhausted. A leg wound gave him atrocious pain. On another level, he could not bear the thought that a new law would compel Talmudic students to enlist for military service, which would surely stop them from learning sacred texts. On the eve of Yom Kippur, he shouted with all his strength, "We must do something. We must do everything to prevent students of Torah from being torn away from Torah." Following the solemn and poignant evening service of Ne'ilah, one of the most beautiful, he turned to a confidant and whispered, "I will not live through the coming year, I know it. Every year at this hour, I would see Prophet Elijah, who would wear white clothes and smile at me. And this evening, he seemed angry." Several weeks afterwards, other disturbing signals appeared. One Shabbat, the biblical portion was read dealing with the sacrifice of the red cow, red heifer, which the sages interpret as atonement for the death of the just man. Just after noon, during the mystical third meal, the disciples were unable to chant the usual hymns. 15 minutes before the end of the Sabbath, the Rebbe recited a psalm which one reads at funerals. In the middle, he stopped and he turned his soul to his Creator. The Hasidim lamented, "Woe to a world that has lost its leader, and woe to the ship that has lost its captain. Or a great darkness has descended upon the world." That was how Rabbi Avrom of Chekhanov echoed. Reb Lipman of Radomsk broke down in tears. He said, "I have nothing more to do in this world. I must now ascend heaven to welcome the Rebbe of Ger next Sabbath with a special song." He died that Sabbath while studying the Zohar, the holy book of splendor. But the first Rebbe of Ger left as a heritage an entire school, an entire movement that still attracts hundreds of followers and disciples. They are recognized by their allegiance to his memory and by their love for his work. His immediate successor, particularly the Sfar Emet, later on his grandson, brought new vigor and lasting honor to his name and accomplishments. Their Hasidim are also known for their solidarity. It is characteristic by the following story, which I heard myself from a Gerer Hasid in the Shtibl on the 102nd Street. One day, the Rebbe asked one of his followers, "How is a certain Hasid? He used to daven with us. I haven't seen him." "Oh, I don't know," says the Hasid. "I haven't seen him either for a long time." "What?" exclaimed the Rebbe. "You are both Hasidim of Ger. You both study the same sources, repeat the same stories, and recite the same prayers, and you don't know what your fellow Hasid is doing, whether he is happy in his business and at peace with his faith, whether his family is healthy, whether his daughters are married, whether they have children, whether they are healthy. You don't know, and you consider yourself a Gerer Hasid?" Several times this evening we have mentioned this tragic destiny. Tragic it was, the most tragic of all. Oh yes, year after year, the child was gone. And in a house of mourning, he observed each time, of course, the laws of mourning. Each time he sat down for the Shiva period and recovered. How did he cope with so much pain? How did he go on living, praying, studying, and teaching while waiting for the next funeral? The last of his sons was Reb Avrom Mordechai, who died at 40 in 1855, leaving behind a widow with many young children. Family, relatives, friends, and Tzipul Hasidim cried at the funeral. But to his wife, the Rebbe said, quote, "Our fate will ultimately be a consolation to others who on similar occasions would be able to say, "Oh, Yitzhak Meir's sorrows were greater than ours, and he didn't complain. Why should we?" As said earlier, I heard this story in the Gerichtstable from survivors of Treblinka. They quoted it each time the greatest tragedy was evoked. Is it possible, is it even conceivable, that at least to his distant Hasidim, his tragedy was meant to be an example to be followed a century later by a different kind of survivors? Is there consolation? As a rule, I always worry over analogies when we deal with the unspeakable event. And therefore, I tell the story of the first rabbi's response to tragedy not as an answer. I fervently believe that in this respect, there is no answer, but as a desire to include it in the vast framework of our collective memory. That wounded memory is condemned to remain until the end of times, an eternal question mark, which God alone can and must answer.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard the second of three lectures in the annual series, The Fascination with Jewish Tales, by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel. Tonight's lecture was titled The Rebbe of Ger, A Tragedy in Hasidism. Introducing Professor Wiesel was Boston University Board of Trustee member Elaine Kirschenbaum. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Mark Liam Bruni. The executive producer for Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.